All right, so in the previous chapter, we finished studying Jesus' final words and teaching and exhortation before his suffering and death. In his teaching and prayer, we touched on several things. One of those was that he promised to send the Holy Spirit to comfort and empower the apostles in his absence. And so that'll be what the book of Acts is all about. We're going to see that come to play shortly after Jesus' death. We know that he appears to about 500 people after his resurrection, and we also know that he's here for probably a month or a little more than a month after his death, so after his resurrection, appearing to those people. Jesus, in these last four chapters that we looked at, prays that God will go through with the plan to save mankind through his personal death, and that this action glorifies both of them. And we read that last week and the week before. And then he expresses love for his apostles because of their faith and prays that God will protect them and enable them to do the mission that they have been entrusted with. And that's what we read last week. And then this final point was that he prays that the love and unity between themselves based on the word will extend to the apostles and to future disciples. And we touched on that at the end of our study last week, where we see that Jesus prayed for all of us, those who would come after the apostles, who are naming the name of Christ because of that same word. And then once completed, Jesus will go across the valley to pray alone in the Garden of Gethsemane, and this is where we're going to begin. So we'll start with John chapter 18, and we'll be reading through that. We'll be reading verses 1 through just the first part of verse 38. So if I can get a volunteer to read John chapter 18, verses 1 and 2.
When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples over the... When Jesus had spoken these words, he went towards his disciples over the ravine of the Kidron, where there was a garden into which he himself entered with his disciples. And Judas also, who was betraying him, knew the place, so Jesus had offered him after his disciples.
All right. So we see that Jesus and his disciples now, they're leaving Jerusalem. They're heading over across the Kidron Valley, which is just like a mile and a half. So we're talking maybe a 30-minute walk. And this is something, obviously, that he had done often. This Kidron Valley was on the road to Bethany. So, and Bethany is where Lazarus and his sisters lived, and that's where Jesus would often stay when he would come to Jerusalem, is in Bethany with Lazarus and Mary and Martha. So this was a well-worn path for Jesus. We know that this is a place that he went often, and it's a place that not only that he, as a destination, but as a pass-through, heading to Bethany, which was another destination where he went regularly when he stayed in Jerusalem. So, having ended the supper, the group leaves the safety of that upper room, and it would be normal for Jesus to leave the city and cross that valley of the Kidron. It's not very deep or long, just about a mile and a half, to take that road to Bethany on the other side, which is what I mentioned here. Bethany is where Martha and Mary and Lazarus lived and where Jesus normally stayed when he was in Jerusalem. And the Garden of Gethsemane was a place where travelers stopped to rest before pushing on the final mile to Jerusalem. So you can see the holy city from the garden. And if you remember, in one of the other Gospels, this is where Jesus had and his disciples were when Jesus looked at the temple and said, not one stone will be left upon another, when he prophesied what would happen in 68, 69, 70 AD. And then so far, it would be normal for the Lord and the apostles to stop and rest at this halfway point between Jerusalem and Bethany. That's just a normal thing for them to do. And perhaps this is why Judas knew where this is where he would find Jesus, because this was a very normal place for them to stop. So, can I get a volunteer to read verses 3 through 9?
Officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees came there
Jesus, knowing all the things that were coming upon him, went forth and said to them, "Whom do you seek?" They answered him, "Jesus the Nazarene." He said to them, "I am he." And Judas also, who was betraying him, was standing with him. So when he said to them, "I am he," they drew back and fell to the ground. Therefore he again asked them, "Whom do you seek?" And they said, "Jesus the Nazarene." Jesus answered, "I told you that I am he. So if you seek me, let these go their way." To fulfill the word which he spoke of those whom you have given me, I lost them.
All right. So note that John does not give any details concerning Jesus' prayers and dialogue with the apostles in the garden that we see in the other Gospels. He completely skips over that. So we, if you remember, this is where Jesus went to pray and told his disciples to stay alert, and they fell asleep. And he came back and found them asleep, and he woke them up and said, "Stay alert," and he went to pray, and this is where he prayed so hard that tears formed and dropped like blood. And then again, he came to his apostles. They were asleep. He woke them up, went the third time. So John completely skips over all that. He does not cover any of that. These are covered well in, like I said, in the other Gospels, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. John describes it in the simplest of terms. We're not going to spend very much time here at all. And he's also not going to cover very much of the time that Jesus spends with the former high priest or the current high priest. He just kind of glosses over it. You get an idea of where it is, but John doesn't spend a lot of time on that stuff. So Judas was accompanied by a mix of Roman soldiers and temple security guards and went to the garden knowing he was going to find Jesus there because he knew Jesus' routine. They had lanterns to search for the area since it was dark in the garden, but they didn't have to search very long because Jesus walked right up to them as soon as he saw them. And then note that Jesus is the one who steps forward and takes them by surprise, asking them to name who they are seeking. And they are so startled that in backing away, they trip and fall. So he just, "I am him," and steps forward towards them, and they just all step backwards and fall away. Obviously, I'm not sure why the Roman cohort would be scared of Jesus. This guy's not wielding a sword or anything like that. He's just a man, and it looks like all of these people are afraid of him. And it goes to show that they understand the power that Jesus wields, that is divine power. Why Roman soldiers would step backwards away from this unarmed man and fall down is unknown to me. And initially when I read it, I thought that, but it doesn't sound like that's the case here. It sounds like they were startled by him. I mean, it was dark, maybe, and, you know, they had their lanterns and stuff, so sounds like they just... And it just depends on what you read. In my particular translation, it says, "So when Jesus said to them, 'I am he,' they retreated and fell to the ground." That doesn't specifically say that they bowed to him. It just says they fell to the ground, like they were backing away from him and tripped. So who knows what's going on with that, but I think that tends to lend to the idea that these men, these Roman cohorts, and these temple priest guards understand who Jesus is. They've seen his power. And Jesus is going to be very clear in his time before the priests that he did none of this in secret. He was very open about what he was doing. He did it in the temple before the Jews. Yeah, go ahead, Carol.
I was just going to say that these guards understand that Jesus had all of this power to feed the multitudes and do this other. Well, what if he has, you know, how rumors get going between people who have to do stuff. What if they think about the fact, well, if he can feed those people, what could he do to us if he wanted to, you know, throw that, you know, just blow us over or whatever. So they just could be scared of the power that he has.
Exactly. And not only that, but again, not in secret, this man brought somebody from the dead in front of witnesses. This man healed a lame man, healed a blind man in front of witnesses. So, some of those were in front of witnesses. Some of them, Jesus, like the blind man, Jesus told, shh, don't tell anybody. And then the blind man went and told people. So, but there are witnesses that have seen the power that Jesus wields. And that kind of power does not stay hidden. People are going to talk about it. And again, we saw in some of our studies in chapters 13 and 14, where Jesus was talking to not just his apostles, but other people, that the crowds tended to hem and haw between supporting him and rejecting him. And because they had seen that he has the power of God. So it doesn't surprise me that these temple guards and these Roman cohort are a little bit scared of him. That I think personally I would be. I mean, to be in the presence of somebody who has the power of God, that is omnipotence and unequal power.
They could admit it.
Go ahead.
Step back, because it sounds...
Old Testament, isn't this what God used to say, I am?
Right, exactly.
And so here's Jesus saying the exact same thing.
Yeah, he says...
language, that would have been, wait a minute.
Yeah, exactly. When God says, I am, and Jesus says, I am he, I am. And so he's, unlike somebody who these guards have been sent out to get before, a robber, a thief, one of these people would tend to run away from the guards, would tend to try to get away from the cohort. Jesus walks right up to him and says, yeah, I'm the one you're looking for. What do you need? Because Jesus knows that he is completely innocent of any charges. He understands this. Now, he knows he's going to pay the price. But Jesus knows that he's not guilty of anything. There's nothing that they can say or do that he is guilty of. But they're going to accuse him and condemn him anyway. So, note that Jesus is the one who steps forward and takes them by surprise by asking them to name who they seek. And they are so startled and backing away, they trip and fall. Note also that even in this episode, Jesus is asking them to confess who they believe him to be. And they answer, Jesus the Nazarene, which is purely his human name. Not Jesus the Son of God. Not Jesus the Messiah. They show him no respect as a teacher or a prophet, and certainly not the Lord and Messiah, just Jesus, the man from Nazareth. So, again, these men, afraid of something supernatural, but treating him like a man. And Jesus repeats that he is the man they seek and demands that they let his apostles go, not just for safety's sake, but also to fulfill what he himself had promised them in the past. And during his ministry, Jesus promised that none except Judas would be lost among his apostles during his time on the earth. And that was John chapter 6 and verse 39 and 17 and 12. And that they escape now is fulfillment of that promise. So can I get a volunteer to read verses 10 and 11? All right, so the other Gospels cover also that Jesus miraculously heals Malchus, which again even throws more of that kindling on the fire for these Roman guards and the temple priest guards, that this man is more than just a man. But Peter, being the boisterous, misunderstanding person that he is from time to time, shows that misunderstanding of the moment and is ready to fight, ready to start a revolution to usher in the new kingdom and the new order of things. And Jesus commands him to stop. And in a reference to his prayer in the garden about the cup of suffering he has agreed to take, Jesus reaffirms his willingness to go to the cross because this is the Father's will. And there will be a revolution and a great change, but it will be accomplished by his death, not by the sword. And it will be accomplished through his resurrection and not through civil war. Jesus did not come here to physically fight a war. He came to establish a spiritual kingdom that would itself rule and destroy that previous kingdom, that is, the Mosaic kingdom that had been established for so long and that was getting ready to leave. It had been fulfilled. It no longer served a purpose, because once Jesus died and was resurrected, he had fulfilled his mission and had established a new kingdom. And that kingdom through the law of Moses was no longer necessary. And then John does not mention it, but in Luke 22 and 51, Luke says that Jesus touched the man's ear and healed him. So again, John kind of skips over some of the details that are covered by the other gospels. But we understand that this man Malchus isn't sitting there earless, that Jesus picks his ear up off the ground and reattaches it, miraculously turning it whole. So that further demonstrates his power before these men. So there were three sessions before the high priests, but John only reports on one. We're only going to read about the one. And so there's the session before Annas, who is the former high priest and father-in-law to the present high priest, Caiaphas. John describes this one. Annas had retired, but as in many situations with leaders, he kept the title of high priest and its influence long after he was not officially in power. So the example that the author of this study guide said was like a president of the United States, still being called Mr. President. Not officially wielding the power anymore, but wielding the respect and the dignity that that office provides. So Annas was in that type of position where he didn't have official power, the official power of the high priesthood, but he was the previous high priest and was recognized as that. So Annas sent Jesus to his son-in-law Caiaphas, the official high priest that year, and along with the other leaders of the Sanhedrin, they questioned Jesus in the late night. And then Caiaphas convened another early morning meeting at which Jesus was condemned. And then Jesus was taken to Pilate, who at first sent him to Herod, and then later questioned and sent him to his death on the cross. So in his gospel, John only describes the session with Annas and Pilate with a brief mention of Caiaphas. And so we're going to see that in the next few verses here. So if I can get a volunteer to read verses 12 through 14.
So the Roman cohort and the commander and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him and led him to Annas first, for he was father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was a high priest that year. Now Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it was expedient for one man to die on behalf of the people.
All right. So between the lines, we are made to understand that Annas has been charged with making a preliminary examination, probably to establish charges against Jesus. John mentions Caiaphas' statement to show that the end of this trial was a foregone conclusion. So Jesus stands before Annas as Annas is trying to find something to accuse him of. And in doing so, can relay that to Caiaphas, who can officially condemn him for it. But again, we all know that they will find nothing to condemn him for. They eventually find something to condemn him for before Pilate, but even Pilate doesn't condemn him for it. And then a volunteer to read verses 15 through 18.
Simon Peter was following Jesus, and so was another disciple. Now that disciple was known to the high priest, and entered with Jesus into the court of the high priest. But Peter was standing at the door outside. So the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the doorkeeper and brought in Peter. The slave girl, therefore, who kept the door, said to Peter, "You are not also one of this man's disciples, are you?" He said, "I am not." Now the slaves and the officers were standing there, having made a charcoal fire, for it was cold, and they were warming themselves, and Peter also was with them, standing and warming himself.
And so we'll see in classic fashion with John, as he normally does here, he just shifts scenes really quick. John gives us kind of the bird's eye view of many things, and this is another one of those situations where we're just kind of watching from up above, seeing what's going on, the whole scene. And so we kind of see the camera pan over from Jesus before Annas over to what's going on with Peter. And so this shift in scene, we see Peter and another disciple had followed from a distance. John is probably referring to himself, because this is how John normally refers to himself in this third person kind of situation. John is probably referring to himself here in that third person as he has done in the past. And we see John does this often in his gospel. These events are taking place in the spring, and it would have been cold in the middle of the night. John records one of the three denials he will make concerning Jesus, again, the cycle. So we're going to see that many of the other Gospels cover this denial much better. But we see that John just kind of, again, bird's eye view of this. And then volunteer to read verses 19 through 24.
The high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. Jesus answered him, "I have spoken openly to the world. I always taught in synagogues and in the temple, where all the Jews come together, and I spoke nothing in secret. Why do you question me? Question those who have heard when I spoke to them. They know what. When he had said this, one of the officers standing nearby struck Jesus, saying, "Is that the way you answer the high priest?" Jesus answered him, "If I have spoken wrongly, testify of the wrong. But if rightly, why do you strike me?" So Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest.
All right. So Annas, with the title high priest, is searching for a charge so that Caiaphas can have something to work with when the Sanhedrin is convened. That is the 70 elders who ruled with permission of Rome, is the Sanhedrin council. This questioning and a meeting of the leaders at night was against the law, but they went ahead with it anyway. And Jesus responds truthfully that what he had taught has been done so openly, and anyone who has heard it can give Annas the information he wants. And the problem is, they know that he has not been teaching anything that is worthy of condemnation. So they have thousands and thousands of witnesses that will testify exactly what Jesus was teaching, which was fulfillment of prophecy of the Old Testament. And there is no one that's going to condemn Jesus for fulfilling Old Testament prophecy. In other words, they had no right and no need to bring him bound to an illegal questioning, because anything they needed to know was already on the public record, known by, like I said, thousands of people. And this accusation made Annas look foolish, and to protect him, one of the guards strikes Jesus with his hand, and that's the worst insult for a Jew. And that's in order to just shut him up, to silence him. And note that he does not challenge what Jesus said. He only defends the position of honor for Annas. And also, it was highly irregular for a guard to strike a bound prisoner while he was making a defense. And in fact, in Roman law, that's illegal to strike a bound prisoner like that, especially if you are a Roman citizen. We see that one of the guards who found out that Paul was a Roman citizen feared for his life, knowing that he had imprisoned Paul without cause and without guilt. And so he just kind of ushered Paul out of the prison and said, go your way, you know, be gone with you. Because he knew that if Paul brought charges against him, it could mean his life. Now, Jesus is not a Roman citizen. So we're not seeing that same kind of Roman protection, but the same kind of protections under Roman law still existed for even non-Roman citizens. As far as being tortured or beat or any sort of physical torture before the condemnation was brought before and you were found guilty. So Jesus has not been found guilty of anything yet he has been hit. And so, again, a violation of Roman law. Jesus does not retaliate against this strike. He merely forces his attacker to consider his motive for striking him. I truly believe in Jesus' heart, he's probably looking out for this guard that is breaking Roman law. And Jesus is just boldly saying, did you really have a reason to strike me as I stand here bound? So we always see from Jesus a point of view that is rare and foreign to most people. That is putting others well before yourself. And I think that's where Jesus is coming from here as well. Seeing that their questioning was getting them nowhere, Annas and those who with him decide to send Jesus to Caiaphas for a more official hearing. If I can get a volunteer to read verses 25 through 27.
Now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself. They said therefore of him, "Are you not the one of his disciples, are you?" He denied it and said, "I am not." One of the slaves of the high priest, being a relative of the one whose ear Peter cut off, said, "Did I not see you in the garden with him?"
And then verse 27, then Peter denied it again, and immediately a rooster crowed. So again, we see the camera panning between Jesus and the priests and Peter sitting by the fire here. And again, we pan over to Peter, and we pick up the scene in the courtyard with Peter, and John records two more denials where Peter's accusers are circling closer to his true identity. With the cock crowing, we have another fulfillment of Jesus' word about Peter, as well as an indication of what time it is. So when does the cock usually crow? Morning, first light, right? So we see that it's no longer nighttime. It is now first light of morning, and we're moving into the legal hours for a trial. So Peter had been the first to openly claim his faith in Jesus as the Christ, and now is one of the first to deny Christ openly when the threat of persecution is at hand. So we see that Peter has always been this very emotional person, leading with his heart instead of his head. And again, that happens here. And some of the other Gospels, again, detail this a lot more in depth, where we not only see that Peter denies, but he denies it vehemently, like cursing and swearing, those kind of things that show that Peter's going to go full bore in the direction that he thinks is proper for himself or for those around him, depending on the mood that he's in at the time. So Peter vehemently just swears that he is not a relation or a disciple of Christ in front of all of these witnesses. And then when he hears the cock crow, we also see that the other Gospels tell us what that does to Peter's heart, and that he is crushed when he remembers what Jesus had told him. And not only that, one of the other Gospels, Peter hears the cock crow and looks over, and Jesus looks at him, which is the fulfillment of what Jesus had told him would happen. And I cannot even imagine Jesus or Peter seeing Jesus look at him when the cock crows. I'm sure that it just utterly destroyed him because he knew that he had failed utterly. So John does not describe any of the details of the trials before Caiaphas and the leaders, this having been done by Matthew, Mark, and Luke in their Gospels. And the trials at night were illegal, and the death sentence could not be pronounced on the same day as the trial. There had to be at least one day intervening. The leaders got around this by having an early morning session, in addition to the late night one, in order to officially pronounce the death penalty. And since the Jews were not allowed to carry out these under Roman law, they brought Jesus to the Roman governor in order to convince him to execute Jesus. Roman courts were open from dawn to sunset, and so in the early morning, 7 to 8 a.m., somewhere around there, Jesus was brought to Pilate. So can I get a volunteer to read verses 28 to 32? All right. So the Jewish leaders, the guards, the other followers, and Jesus stand outside the governor's quarters, not entering a Gentile abode for fear of defilement. They would be ceremoniously unclean and thus unable to participate in some of the remaining Passover activities. The leaders broke laws to condemn unjustly the Messiah, but were not willing to break a ceremonial rule to eat food at the Passover. So, I mean, we saw at least two laws being broken against Jesus in the last few verses, but they're unwilling to enter a unclean Gentile's place of abode so that they can participate in the Passover. This is the kind of thinking that Jesus has been dealing with for 3 years, where they, as he put it, follow every jot and tittle, but put away the weightier matters of the law. So they tithe dill and cumin, you know, just minutia of tithing, but they take away the homes of the widows and orphans, those kind of things where they are absolutely blind to the most important parts of the law, which is putting others before yourself and taking care of the little stuff. So this is what Jesus has been dealing with the whole time. And I'm sure that in his heart, he sees this hypocrisy and is like just shaking his head. So Roman law and trials required accuser and accused to face each other before a Roman judge to argue over the validity of a charge. Pilate, as governor, serves also as judge and begins the proceedings with a request to know the charge. The Jews know that there is no way a Roman judge would consider a case based on Jewish religion, so they make a generic charge against Jesus as an evildoer, because they have no charge against him. Pilate, refusing to be manipulated, tells them, therefore, judge him according to their law. They do not need him. And then the Jews come out with their true intention. They are looking for the death penalty, something that only a Roman judge can grant. And John inserts an editorial comment here, reinforcing the fact that even if Jesus is bound and silent at this point, he has already spoken about this event and foretold of its coming. In other words, Jesus controls even this situation because he called it in advance. He knew this was going to happen. He knew exactly what kind of trial this was going to be, that it was not going to be legal, and it was not going to be just. It was going to be a sham. So can I get a volunteer to read verses 33 through 38? Verses 33 through 38.
Therefore Pilate entered again into the praetorium and summoned Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Are you saying this on your own initiative, or did others tell you about me?" Pilate answered, "I am not a Jew, am your own nation, and the chief priest delivered you to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "Then my servants would be fighting so that I would be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm." Therefore Pilate said to him, "So you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You say correctly that I am a king. For this I have been born, and for this I have come into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Pilate said to him, What is truth?" And when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said to them, "I find no guilt."
Okay. So we'll get into a few things here that are very telling. So once Pilate hears of their request for the death penalty, he takes custody of Jesus and brings him to the praetorium, that is the courtyard inside the government complex of buildings, and he officially begins the trial with the questioning of Jesus. So Pilate begins with the accusation that could potentially carry the death sentence. To declare oneself a leader or a king without Roman approval could lead to execution. Jesus tests Pilate to see if he himself really believes this accusation or if Jesus looks like one who would do this. And Pilate is insulted, replying that he is the governor and judge. He is not a Jew personally involved in the matter. However, he sees that the Jews are out to kill Jesus and he wants to know what they are so worked up about. And the cycle continues as Jesus, this time before the pagan Roman official, proclaims his true nature and position as not being part of this physical world. He is very logical, and if he were a king of this world, there would be fighting and civil war, which the Jews accuse him of stirring up to gain favor with the Roman governor. But Jesus knows that Pilate has not had any such reports about him, and there are no witnesses to any of those types of accusations. Jesus never fomented civil war or any kind of physical confrontation. The Lord acknowledges the part of the accusation that is true, that he is a king, and corrects the part which is not true, that he's not a secular or worldly king. He's a king of a place that is not on this world. It is a spiritual kingdom. And the Romans may have taken offense to him calling himself a king and leading people in a kingly way physically, but that's not what Jesus was about. Jesus was about a spiritual kingdom, a way to heaven. And Pilate recognizes that there is no way that he can accuse Jesus of this matter, because there is no guilt found in him. The accusations are false. They are baseless. And he then tells the Jews, "This is a matter of your religion. Take care of it yourself." But they say, "We want to kill him." And so they have to have some sort of accusation against him that would stick under Roman law. So they have to trump up the charge as much as possible in order to fulfill this accusation against Jesus. So Pilate, understanding this, is now curious. He asks the Lord to explain more about that type of king, the type of king he is, and he probably expected Jesus to deny the charge, but when he does not, Pilate now wants some clarification. And Jesus proclaims his kingship more fully and in a way that would engage and challenge this pagan person before him. He makes a confession of his true person, a divine king that has come to the world to bring the truth. And the invitation to Pilate is to pursue this truth, a truth that every person who seeks the truth will pursue. The question left open to Pilate is, are you a truth seeker? And we all know how Pilate responds to this. Just a very sad response. What's truth? Because to a person like that, there's 100 shades of gray. So which truth are you talking about? Pilate's response is so sad because it is missing one little word that would have made all the difference. And if he would have said, what is the truth? This would have been an open door of his heart to let Jesus know that he had some interest, that there is something in Pilate that's worth trying to save. But he answered, what is truth? And which, that's recognizing what Jesus was saying, but refusing to engage in the discussion. And that's where Pilate was. He was just gutless. His point was like most educated Romans at the time, skeptical, suspicious, and self-serving. And the best truth was that which pointed or provided opportunity for self, because that was number one in the Roman Empire, was looking out for yourself. Everybody has a truth, but there can really be only one. Is there really only one certain truth? That was Pilate's point of view. And we'll end it there with Pilate unwilling to engage Jesus in a potential to save Pilate's life. Because Jesus isn't worried about his own life. Jesus is worried about the lives of all of those who have come before him and will go after him, who are not leading sinless lives. And Pilate was one of those. And Jesus made an attempt. But unlike Festus and the Agrippa, who Paul engaged with, Pilate is unwilling to engage. That'll end it for today. Dean will take over for next week, and you guys will continue into this sham trial with Jesus.